Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now, chances are pretty good that you are surrounded by plastic. A plastic keyboard, a plastic water bottle, plastic fixtures in your car, maybe plastic toys, a plastic case on your phone. Plastics are an important part of our society. They're also a huge part of an environmental disaster that's particularly easy to see in our oceans and waterways. This hour, we'll talk about the role of plastics in our lives and in the life of our planet. We'll talk about the future of plastics and how technology might make them more environmentally friendly. And we'll also talk about what you can do to cut down on your use of single-use plastics. And you can join our conversation a little later on at 866-780-9100. Carolyn Raffensperger, chair of the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club, will join us in a few minutes. We're going to start the hour with a scientist who's working to change the future of plastic. David Gruhl is a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University and the director of the Center for Bioplastics at ISU. Hello, David.
Good morning, Lindsay, and I really appreciate and want to say thanks for the opportunity to talk about the stuff that we're doing here at Iowa State.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And before we dive into what you're doing at the Center for Bioplastics, tell me about what got you into this line of work. What are your concerns that drive you?
Well, I guess it started many years ago. Coming out of college, I focused on plastics, and so I'm a polymer processing type person. And, you know, I've been doing that for many, many years. And as I saw more and more of these images that everybody sees on TV, they see on the cover of magazines, these images of plastics floating in the ocean. And now we're hearing more and more about these microplastics that get into the water systems, into our fresh water, and how these fish are intaking these and the adverse effects that these materials are having on the environment. And so, many years ago after that, I started to looking into, well, how can we make this great material? Because plastics are a great material. As you started out talking about, you know, everything that you touch on a daily basis is probably either is made of plastic or has been packaged in plastics and so on. And there's lots of advantages. So how can we offset some of these adverse effects that plastics have on the environment? And just the old saying, you know, trying to leave the planet in a better place than what we found it.
Well, and we will talk about some ways that we can cut down on the amount of plastic we use in our lives. But given how incredibly important plastic is in the way we live, do you feel that really the emphasis needs to be on making plastic more environmentally friendly?
As a material standpoint, yes. Yes, it needs to be more environmentally friendly. But also, just all the R's, right? It's the recycle. It's the reuse, the repurpose, being renewable. So being bio-based, I think, is a part of making the impact of plastics being smaller. And so it is all of those. And, we see a lot of different places do better jobs than some of us do in terms of the four R's.
Now, the Center for Bioplastics is part of the National Science Foundation, and Iowa State University is not the only place where work is being done with the Center for Bioplastics. Give me an overview of what this organization is.
Yeah, correct. So it is funded by the National Science Foundation, and we started about 4 years ago, actually, as a center, and probably 6 years ago, we started contemplating the idea of going after an IUCRC, which is a industry university cooperative research center. And there's approximately 70 of these centers throughout the nation, and we're the only one focused on bioplastics and biocomposites. There's one, for example, on big data and so on. So they all have a different theme, and our theme is looking at sustainable materials. And we started it with Washington State University, and Vic Yanata at Washington State is the current center director, site director there, and Iowa State is the lead institution, and I'm the director of that. And we have a couple other universities that are looking to join. For example, University of Georgia is looking to join. They just executed a fairly successful planning grant a few months ago, and it looks like they're going to join as a third site. And North Dakota State University is also looking to join as well. So we're growing in terms of sites, and each site had its own particular thrust areas. We do a fair amount of things with synthesis here at Iowa State. So, for example, Eric Cochran in chemical engineering, he takes glycerin from the biodiesel industry, which is a co-product. So when you make biodiesel, taking animal fat or soybean oil and heating it up and adding some ethanol and some sodium hydroxide, for example, you get biodiesel. But then you get this co-product that is relatively low value. And Eric's figured out some very unique chemistries that are fairly straightforward on how to turn them into binders for asphalt or possibly even using them to make adhesives. And in Washington State, they do a lot in the area of wood-based composites. University of Georgia is going to be focusing on packaging as well as looking at trying to have offsets to wood-based plastics. And in North Dakota, they're going to be focusing on paints and coatings. And as a center itself, you know, we do a lot of different things. We do, you know, bioplastics, biocomposites, adhesives. We look at the technical economic analysis and the things focused on life cycle assessment. And so we get involved in basically everything that's encompassed in sustainable materials. Now, when I say that we get funded by the National Science Foundation, I do really want to emphasize, though, that the vast majority of our money comes from industry. So we have industry partners that give us money each year to fund the research. And you know, these are small to large companies. We have companies such as Ford and Hyundai, ADM and 3M and John Deere. And then we also have smaller companies. One of our founding member companies was Segwerk, a company that's got a research facility down in Des Moines, Iowa. And we're working with them on pigments and dyes that are going to be bio-based that could go in either to petrochemical plastics or it could go into bioplastics.
Well, you were using the term bioplastics, but define that for me. Explain what that means.
Well, maybe we ought to back up. You know, what is a plastic, first of all? And it's a man-made polymer. And polymers have been around since the beginning of time. You know, nature has been using polymers for a number of different things like energy storage, starch. Starch is polymerized sugars. Nature can also polymerize that into chitin. And chitin is what seashells and so on and crustaceans are made out of. And in hair is polymerized protein. So, but when we look at what we've done as a society, you know, back many years ago, back in 1907, if I get it right, Bakelite was invented. And this was the first synthetic plastic. So we, instead of taking sugar molecules and stacking them all together into very large molecules and polymerizing them, Bakelite, this guy Leo Bakeland, had developed a technique to develop this synthetic plastic based upon petrochemical feedstocks. So we got all these little molecules that are strand together, and that's why plastics are so great, because they're very strong for their weight. And so these plastics became more and more prevalent. And bioplastics have been around for many years, even before that. So we can go back all the way back into something back in 1865, when cellulose acetate was first developed. But then as petrochemical feedstocks became more cost competitive, the bioplastics started to go away. We stopped using things like casein or milk protein to make bioplastics, and more petrochemical plastics became more prevalent. But now with you know, what we're seeing in terms of the media coverage of what the adverse effects of these are, we're starting to see more of these come about. And not all bioplastics are degradable. I know a lot of people gravitate towards that, that if I take a natural feedstock, whether that's corn or sugar from sugarcane or cellulose or whatever, and turn that into a plastic, that does not necessarily mean that it's going to be degradable or biodegradable, depending on what we're talking about, or even compostable. So when we talk about biodegradable plastics, we have to be very careful about that, that not all bio-based plastics are degradable, but in nature.
So do you see an environmental benefit to bioplastics, even if they are not biodegradable, because that they're not using as much petroleum?
Yeah, if you look at the life cycle assessment, yeah, they have a smaller, for the most part, not all, but for the most part, most of them have a smaller carbon footprint. So when we look at what we do in terms of making a bioplastic, let's say, for example, if we look at what NatureWorks does of making PLA or polylactic acid, you know, they harvest the corn, a lot of it coming from Iowa, take it over to Nebraska, take that corn, extract the starches, turn the starch into sugar, give that to a microbe, make lactic acid. And so this whole process is rather intense. So it's not without having some carbon. But if we look at how much that is compared to synthetic plastic, in the most part, we'll see that they have a smaller carbon footprint. And Braskem, that makes polyethylene from sugarcane, has seen the same thing in their life cycle assessments, that they see smaller carbon footprints.
So when people hear bioplastics, and you talked about some of the large corporations that you're partnering with, including car companies, I'm sure that there are some people who are a little bit worried. Like, if you make bioplastics, are they as strong as the kind of plastic that we're used to? Because if you're driving around in a car with a lot of plastic components, you clearly don't want that degrading on you.
Yeah, exactly. So those are going to be more of the durable plastics. And a lot of people probably every day touch bioplastics without even realizing it. So, for example, Coca-Cola with their plant-based bottle. The plastic that that's made from is polyethylene terephthalate. And for many, many years, that's all been 100% based upon petrochemical feedstock. But Coca-Cola made a decision to incorporate a bio-based content, and they're up to one-third, and up to one-third of the plastic can be bio-based. And in that case, it's what we call a one-to-one drop-in. So the polyethylene terephthalate that Coke makes their bottles out of is the exact chemical structure as one that comes from a petrochemical feedstock. And so that's a strong plastic. And so there's examples of that where every day you touch something. And there's other bioplastics. Nylon 11 has been historically made out of castor bean oils. And that's a plastic that's very strong. And so there's an example of that. Ford Motor Company, for example, every Ford vehicle that's manufactured in the United States has 32,000 soybeans in it. And most of that is in the seat and the foams. So there's an example where it's a plastic. It's going to last as long as a petrochemical feedstock, but it's based upon the soybeans, and a lot of which I'm sure are coming out of the state of Iowa.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to David Gruhl. He's professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University and director of the Center for Bioplastics. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about plastic. It's an important part of all of our lives. It's also part of a giant environmental disaster. We're talking about shaping the future of plastics, making them more environmentally friendly because plastic is not going away. We're also going to focus in just a few minutes on ways that you can reduce the amount of plastic that you use in your life, particularly single-use plastics. Carolyn Raffensperger, chair of the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club, is going to join us in just a few minutes. With me right now is David Gruhl. He's a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University and director of the Center for Bioplastics. And David, before the break, we were getting a better understanding of what bioplastics are. Now, I do want to talk about making bioplastics that are biodegradable, because, of course, one of the huge problems that we encounter is that we have all of these plastics in our lives. About 75% of it gets thrown away. A lot of it, of course, is going to stay in the environment forever, whether that's in a landfill or, unfortunately, in a waterway or in the ocean. So when we talk about biodegradable plastic, what happens to that plastic when you create it? Can you create a plastic that can break down entirely?
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, there's companies that do that. They use NatureWorks that makes PLA or polylactic acid. But we do need to back up a little bit and talk about what we mean by biodegradable. Because if you were to say that PLA is biodegradable, a lot of people would cringe. We'd probably want to call it compostable.
Okay.
And so what we mean is that you can take that plastic, and if you put it into a composting facility where the humidity is correct, the temperature is correct, and it's got the right conditions, microbes will basically consume the plastics. This is like we would eat our lunch. And so the first thing, there's some things that happen. We hydrolyze or we add water to the plastic to make that long polymer chain a little bit shorter. But then at one point, the microbes consume it. And, you know, this lactic acid is very common. So if you go running and don't eat your bananas or don't drink enough water and you get leg cramps afterwards, that's an accumulation of lactic acid in your muscles that causes these cramps. So it's a common chemical in the environment. And so the microbes can consume that, break that down, and turn that back into either carbon dioxide or methane. And we maybe can catch that methane and burn it if it's done in a anaerobic digestion type. And one of our member companies, Myrant, they make PBS. And that one is also biodegradable or compostable. So there's plastics commercially available on the market right now. And if you go to your grocery store, a lot of some of the packaging is already made out of these plastics.
And if you have biodegradable or compostable plastic packaging, as you just said, it has to be in the right kind of environment for those plastics to break down. So let's say you buy something in that kind of packaging, but then you just throw it away, then that doesn't make much of a difference, does it?
Well, it does from the carbon footprint, right? Because when we make PLA or we make PBS that Myrant makes, they've captured that CO2 out of the atmosphere, and the plant did that, right? The corn captured it, and now we've taken that corn and sent that through a fermentation process. And I also want to point out, a lot of times, you know, just like with the corn to ethanol model, that corn is also still used for animal feed. So we're not diverting anything in terms of animal feed and turn it into a plastic. So that plant has captured it, and we've used it, and we've captured it. And so, okay, let's say we throw it into the trash. And if you live in the city of Ames, that then is going to end up in the facility where they burn it. And so now we've actually even captured that CO2, made plastic out of it, used it. And then if we burn it, or if we do an anaerobic digestion, if we did throw it into a recycling facility and capture the methane production, we've now also ended up with recovering the energy that we've put into this and the sun's put into this. So, you know, burning it may be another alternative. If you're burning it correctly, you can't just burn any plastic. Some plastics that have chlorine in them and so on can have adverse effects. But as long as you sort those through and you burn under the right conditions like the city of Ames does, you can actually recover the energy from it.
Well, and I want to talk about a major success story, and this has to do with a garden product. Tell me about the biodegradable plastic, or I guess the compostable plastic pots that some plant starters are coming in.
Yeah, so this started many years ago. A student of Bill Graves came to me, and he knew I was working in the area of protein-based plastics. So we take protein from corn or soybean, and we would make plastics out of them. And he had this crazy idea of, what if we make a pot out of this? And these are pots like you go to your local gardening store and you get your tomato plant. And, you know, and if you do like I do, you take the plant out of the plastic container. And the first thing you do is you break open the root system because you got this root circling where the roots go around the circle. And you put the thing in the ground and you throw away the plastic, and that's the last you've seen of it. But he had the idea that since we're making these pots, or we could potentially make these pots out of soy protein or corn protein, maybe what we could do then is have that protein act as a functional purpose, such as being a nitrogen source or self-fertilizing. So, and they're degradable. So that was the idea. And we started out, and this is a good example of where sometimes you have to really do it to really see what happens. And we started making them out of corn protein because corn protein is water stable. And being growing up on a farm, you would have thought or realized this, but what we landed up doing was killing a lot of plants because corn protein is a good herbicide. And so we had to go back and look at protein, and the disadvantage of that is that soy protein is not water stable. So if I make a cup out of soy protein, pour water in it, in a couple minutes I get tofu. That's basically what I get. And so that's not going to work. So it took us a couple years to go through the formulations, but we had a pot that was fully bio-based. It's self-fertilized, and so what we recommend is you pull the pot off the root ball. And the first thing you're going to notice, though, is that you do not have root circling. And this was a side effect that we did not anticipate at all. And in fact, what the root ball does, it has twice as many root nodules as what would normally be found in a petrochemical pot. And so the root system is much healthier, and we see a 100% increase in the amount of fruit. So, for example, tomatoes or peppers, these plants are much, much healthier grown in one of these pots compared to another one. So in our pot, you pull it off, and what we recommend is you go ahead and crush the pot up and put that into the hole because it still has fertilizing effects. And the way we've designed it, it'll disappear in about a year or two. And put the tomato plant or pepper plant, whatever it is, on top. And now you get twice as much fruit with not nearly as much fertilizer. You don't have to add any fertilizer to it. And these are commercially available. So a company, Self Eco, up in Minnesota, sells these through Amazon as well as Walmart.
And is this an area where we're seeing a lot of growth?
It is slow coming into this because growers, we like to, you know, these are being sold right now primarily to individual growers. And in order to make a big impact, we need to break into getting into commercial growers. That's where you're going to see the big impact is if we can get into those. And as with any system, you know, people, as with bioplastics, everybody that, you know, is reluctant to do something new where if something goes wrong, it's going to have a big impact on the cost and, you know, profitability of the company. So, and it's a little bit of a, you know, the problem with bioplastics are coming on is getting past that something new doesn't really work in the concerns that everybody has with those.
I'm talking with David Gruhl. He's a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University and director of the Center for Bioplastics. David, stay with us. I also want to bring now Carolyn Raffensperger into the conversation. She is chair of the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club and director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. Hello, Carolyn.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I'm so delighted to share in the conversation.
And, of course, we've been talking about trying to make plastic more environmentally friendly, the impact that technology can have through that movement. But, of course, a lot of us, as I mentioned, we interact with plastic on a daily basis. A lot of us are throwing a lot of plastic away on a daily basis. So individual behavior changes also has to be something that is a part of cutting down on the amount of plastic in our environment today. And Carolyn, that's something that I know that you have focused a great deal on. Before we talk about sort of some practical ways that people can cut down on their use of plastic, I'd like you to give me your view of the big picture. What are your greatest concerns about the amount of plastic we're using right now?
Oh, I want to start with how I got involved in this in the first place, like David did, because I think it leads directly into the problems with plastic. When I was growing up, my father was surgeon-in-chief at Children's Memorial Hospital in Chicago, so he operated on all of certain classes of birth defects and all of certain kinds of childhood tumors. And one day he came home and he said that the increase in both birth defects and childhood tumors that he was seeing over the course of his career were humanly caused. And I said, well, why don't you do something about it? It was so shocking to me that we would be causing human suffering. And he said, I can't prove it. And later in my career, I discovered that there were all these chemicals out in the environment that were actually interfering with the hormones in our bodies. This is called endocrine disruption. And those hormones have all sorts of biological effects. They regulate our hunger, they regulate reproduction, they regulate puberty, they have all of these important roles in our lives. And chemicals in plastics and chemicals in pesticides were interfering with these hormones. And so we know that there are all sorts of biological impacts from these endocrine disrupting chemicals. And we didn't really fully understand that array of impacts until the mid-1990s. We had started to get a flavor of it from Rachel Carson's work, Silent Spring, that we could silence the birds. We could, but we didn't understand how very small quantities of chemicals in things like plastics could interfere with our reproduction, with our puberty, with our weight, until about the mid-1990s. And at that time, I had been looking at how we make decisions about environmental problems that we face, whether it's climate change. You know, is the science certain? Is it really certain that a pesticide or one of the plasticizers in plastics can actually interfere with our health? Could they cause cancer? Could they cause birth defects? And so the question was, how do we deal with that scientific uncertainty? And in 1998, I convened a conference at the Wingspread Center on something called the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle says that in the face of scientific uncertainty, the likelihood of harm, you take precautionary action. That meant you didn't wait until you had all of the evidence to take precautionary action and prevent harm, prevent birth defects, prevent the cancers that were humanly caused by these chemicals and other things that we were doing and putting into the environment. And it was revelatory. There's quite a bit of law that has been changed based on this idea called the precautionary principle. San Francisco adopted it as their overarching law for environmental policy. There are a number of international treaties that now govern toxic chemicals or called persistent organic pollutants. And plastics are a key source of some of these chemicals that last a long time, the chlorinated and fluorinated compounds. So we put these endocrine-disrupting chemicals into plastics, and then they leach out when we put them into our food wrap or food packaging, or when we put them in our rubber duckies or in our siding on our house. So we've talked a little bit about the difference between these durable plastics that are going to last a long time, like PVC and the siding on our houses or in our flooring, and yet the problems that are associated with both these one-time use plastics and these longer, more durable plastics are often very similar. So we've been working on different approaches to these kinds of chemicals. And one of the key ideas that David raised is that you look for alternatives to harmful activities. And it's one way of implementing this idea called the precautionary principle. You look for an alternative to that harmful activity so you can meet your goals. And so these bioplastics are one way. But, you know, we lived before plastics and had other things that we used to perform some of these same services. So saran wrap evolved during World War II because aluminum was in short supply. It was being sent to military uses so that we could win the war. And people found alternatives for aluminum, and these cheap plastics were one of them. So we began using saran wrap in our daily use. There are plenty of other things that we can use in our daily lives besides saran wrap.
Well, and right now, the thing that people are really focusing on when they're talking about plastics are the things that they can see. So while you became concerned about plastics because of the idea of these chemicals interacting with us, there are a lot of people now who maybe haven't been thinking about that for years, but now can visually see the plastics polluting our oceans, or, you know, the plastics that just can be found everywhere in our environment and the problems that those things are causing. So let's also take a look at that picture, because, you know, these plastics are entering the environment and staying there.
It's one of the hallmarks of this generation that we are altering the entire surface of the planet, and those alterations will now be permanent, or as permanent as humans can imagine time. We are now causing changes for future generations that will last 250,000 years. there are now fossils being made out of plastic. And I consider this a tragedy. I began my career as an archaeologist, and my specialty are the Pueblos of the Southwest. And I have to tell you, the things that the Pueblos left us are stunningly beautiful. The pottery, the beads, the stone tools. I know that when an Iowan finds an arrowhead in their field, they have a sense of awe. And what are our great-great-grandchildren going to feel when they find a styrofoam cup, when they find the remnants of our Tupperware as the legacy of this generation? So I would invite us to leave much better quality garbage for future archaeologists.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Carolyn Raffensperger is here, chair of the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club, and David Gruhl, professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join us, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about plastics. We started the hour talking about ways that technology can make plastics more environmentally friendly. And now we want to focus on ways that we can try to limit the amount of plastic that we use in our lives, at least the amount of plastic that we're throwing away. With me is David Gruhl. He's a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University and the director of the Center for Bioplastics. Carolyn Raffensperger is here, chair of the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club and director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. And we've been asking people to tweet us and tell us ways that they have limited the amount of plastics that they use in their lives. So Juan tweets that he shops using baskets and or fabric bags. We also heard from someone who says, I carry a take-home container in the car to use at restaurants. Nicole says, I bring my own reusable water bottle everywhere, and I recently bought metal straws to avoid purchasing or using plastic ones. I also recycle as much as I can. And Carolyn, I'll start with you. And I want to start with recycling, because that's something that a lot of people do. A lot of people participate in recycling programs. It makes a lot of us feel better about the plastic that we use in our lives. But really, a very limited amount of the plastic that we interact with ends up getting recycled, right?
That is actually true. A lot of it can't be recycled. But even recycling is problematic. So a lot of the plastic water bottles and other things that get recycled are made into fleece. And so if you look and it says polyester fleece, those fibers can actually peel off in the washing of them, and then go into our waterways. And they are so small that filtration doesn't get them out. So it's one of the problems with the oceans and with a lot of our water sources, that these materials that are being recycled are actually causing ongoing problems. So the best answer is, don't buy them in the first place. Don't use them in the first place. Get rid of them. Yes, if you absolutely can't find an alternative, recycle it. But what we are now doing with those recycled materials is problematic.
Well, and David, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well. What do you think about recycling of plastic? Is that something that's working for us?
Well, you know, when you look at it, only, you know, a small percentage of plastics, as Carolyn indicated. And good morning, Carolyn. And I want to first, you know, applaud your efforts and so on, and I'm really grateful to see, you know, people being concerned about these chemicals that are coming out in our environment. So it is an issue of the recycling, but, you know, it is all of them, right? It can't be just one solution. It's not going to be just the recycling. It's going to be the reuse, the repurpose, being renewable, and so on. Here's an anecdotal story of a possible recycling, repurposing. Chris Martin and his wife, Tammy Martin, I hope they don't feel offended me using their names, they went to Ghana to help young people. When they got there, they didn't have the resources to do what they wanted to do in teaching computer science as well as being sustainable. And they found that all around Ghana was all these plastic pouches and that were drink boxes, basically. And they had reused those and made them into wallets, purses, all kinds of things. And they shipped them back to the United States, and a bunch of us bought them. And they made enough money to do what they wanted to do in Ghana. So there are, you know, applications where recycling is good, but it's mostly going to be about, you know, being renewable and reduce, you know. And reducing packaging is being done. If you go to the grocery store, you see these stand-up pouches. And they use a significant less amount of plastic compared to traditional you know, bottles and so on. And, you know, you see people putting soup in them, drinks in them, and so on. So, you know, I think that while, yeah, recycling is definitely a key part of it, it's also reduce.
And speaking of packaging, I mean, that's one of the most difficult places to really avoid interacting with plastic, because it does seem to be surrounding everything that you want to buy. Carolyn, I'd love to hear a little bit from you about your journey with this, because I know that you've spent many years trying to weed the single-use plastics out of your life. So let's talk about packaging. How do you avoid it?
Well, I bring as little as possible into my house in the first place. And to the extent possible, I try to buy things that are either packaged in glass or some other material that is easily recyclable. So a glass container can be recycled into another glass container pretty much ad infinitum. But, you know, plastic, it's tough. So I start by bringing as little into my house. I affirm not using plastic bags at the grocery store. And then buying things that have alternative packaging. So one of the things you can do is, if you're buying cheese, some of it comes wrapped in plastic, or you can go to the deli, and they'll put it in wax paper, and I get it wrapped in aluminum foil, partly because plastic, food that's fatty, leaches the chemicals out of the plastic. Don't microwave in plastic. So I replaced plastic storage containers with glass. I go to Goodwill or other thrift stores and buy all of the glass or porcelain ceramic storage containers for preserving food and freezing food to get as much plastic out of my diet. We end up eating it because it's leached into the food. And by the way, don't microwave in plastic. It is a terrible idea. If you want to get a major hit of chemicals from plastics, that's a good way to do it. So look for those alternatives in food packaging and think, when you're at the point of purchase, if there's an alternative to doing it. So you can buy ketchup in a glass bottle or a plastic bottle. Buy the glass bottle.
We're talking about ways to reduce the amount of plastic that we use in our lives. We'd love for you to join our conversation. Is this something that you've been working on? What is working for you? How do you reduce the amount of plastic you use in your life? Is there a kind of plastic you haven't been able to avoid? We'd love to hear that, too. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. With me, Carolyn Raffensperger, chair of the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club and director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. David Gruhl is also here, professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University and director of the Center for Bioplastics. And we have another plastic scientist on the line. Keith is on the line in Ames. Hi, Keith.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. And you wanted to bring up something that you felt you disagreed with Carolyn about.
Well, there's a couple things that are a little bit concerning that I want your listeners to understand. I do work in plastics and packaging research only at Iowa State University and direct a center here. Or a consortium, I should say, a polymer and food protection consortium. And we're supported by, you know, companies and even folks like CalRecycle out in California. While I do agree with some of Carolyn's statement about the damaging effects, I personally do not microwave some of our plastics. We've actually published in this area, both in Food and Analytical Methods and different manuscripts. And I just want everyone, you know, some folks to be aware that we've worked on various projects looking at eliminating plastics from retailers. So we work publicly. We work with Whole Foods or one of our member companies, Whole Foods Market. And what we found was that when you eliminate plastics in some of these products, and you know, when you make statements like all plastics are bad, they all contribute to poisoning, you're going to get sick when you eat them, when you eat out of them or use them, what you basically do is you send retailers scrambling and you send brand owners scrambling looking for an alternative plastic or an alternative substrate. So we had that happen as a result of some PR with some folks that were really just not educated and hadn't bothered to look at the peer-reviewed literature, research. So they scrambled, went out and sourced some fiber from outside of the U.S. They sourced some what we call bioplastic or some biomaterials from, we had some come in from India. And what we found, India, China, some from Central and South America. And they were starting to move into these products to get out of plastic. And what we found when we tested these products coming from some of these suppliers was they actually were higher in heavy metals, higher in extractables, and much, much more dangerous to use than the plastic that the retailer was currently using. So we presented the data to the retailers and the brand owners and said, this is really what you moved into without really doing your homework on the alternative. So what happens is you just get this, we're gonna rush to find an alternative substrate because everyone thinks, oh, plastics are all bad. And I agree. Some, you know, I personally, like I said, I do not microwave plastics. I've just made it an effort to not do that with myself or my family. But we've done extensive work on water bottles. We've done extensive work. I have in my lab, I have food service ovens from major quick serve restaurants or, you know, think the fast food places of the world. We work on their packaging. We do extractables testing in my lab every day. We do CFR extractables testing. We do heavy metals analysis every day in my lab, looking at lead, mercury, cadmium, chromium. And many of the plastics, we have not found contamination levels above what we consider to be environmental contaminants. They're just not there. We can't get an extractable response. You know, and we're down into the low part per billion range. And the reality is some of the contaminants that we're pointing with fingers and saying this must be coming from plastics is really some of the environmental noise that we see. And so to make it's just a huge jump to say all plastics are bad. It's other a huge, huge jump to say all plastics might be causing cancer or might be causing this, or you just can't say that. There's just no data to support that. There's no academic data to support that.
So
in
let me
some
respond
cases,
to that.
Yeah, sure.
Let me respond.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the clarification on that. And I certainly hope I didn't say all plastics. I know that there's been a great deal of work to remove the toxic chemicals that we knew about, you know, BPA, phthalates, and things like that. And that there has been a move towards cleaner plastics that do not leach those toxic chemicals out. But the point is the consumer can't tell. You made the other point that we can rush to judgment, not do the homework, and replace them with things that bring other kinds of problems. Absolutely, and we don't want to do that. It's one of the reasons for supporting public interest research at universities like yours and like Dave, you know, like David's doing. We need to put public dollars into sustainability and look for those materials that are going to let us live lightly on the planet, not contaminate children. So you said parts per billion. And what we know about endocrine disruptors is that if you do have some of that environmental noise, maybe from old plastics, who knows from what, that those small amounts of chemicals can actually affect babies in utero. They can affect puberty. And we can't tell and we can't see. So the question is, how do we become protective and how do we look long-term into the future for protecting us against exactly the kinds of things that you described?
Well, and David, do you have anything you want to add to this part of the conversation?
Well, and there's also, you know, to Carolyn's point as well as Keith, there's also a big drive to looking at alternative chemicals to do that, right? We add these chemicals to plastics for a number of different reasons, for manufacturing, for processing, and so on.
And so Brent Shanks, a professor at Iowa State, heads up a center, NSF center, on biorenewable chemicals. And so some of the things that they're deriving are bio-based chemicals that can be added to plastics. Now, just because it's bio-based doesn't mean it's not harmful. So we do have to be careful, to Carolyn's point. Nicotine, it's bio-based, it's natural, but it wouldn't necessarily advocate that you consume large quantities of nicotine. So, but, you know, there is work going on trying to make alternatives that are more environmentally and health conscious.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for your call and bringing up such an important point, because as a consumer, so many of us go into the store and really don't have the kind of information that can help us make informed and healthy choices. We have just a couple of minutes left. And so before we run out of time, David, I'd love to ask you, as somebody who is looking toward a future of more environmentally friendly plastics, tell me how far that future is away from us. When do you see real change reaching the marketplace?
Well, it's got to happen sooner than later. There's a report out, whether it's, you know, you take it for what it is, saying that by the year 2050, which is not that far away, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish. And that just absolutely terrifies me, that there's going to be that much plastic in the ocean. And, you know, the big concern is there's big pieces that's easy to see and maybe not easy to collect, but you can collect them, break down into smaller plastics, and what happens to those and the fish and so on. So something that has to happen fairly, you know, sooner than later in order to take care of the plastics issue. And, you know, and I'm not saying bioplastics is the solution, right? Bioplastics is a part of the solution to take care of some of these problems. And we've seen now that the bioplastics market has grown to something that's about 1% of the larger picture. So it's small, but we have broken that 1%, that market. And so, you know, I think that as that growth continues, we're seeing about a 20% increase in the use of manufacturing of bio-based plastics. And so, you know, it's growing. And so I think, you know, we're not that far off of having it become something that's going to be part of the solution, but not necessarily the solution, not definitely not the solution, but part of a bigger solution.
David Gruhl, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
David Gruhl is a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University and director of the Center for Bioplastics. And Carolyn, we have just about a minute here left for you. Right now, we are seeing a great deal of awareness grow about the problems that plastics are causing in our environment. We've seen, you know, National Geographic bring a great deal of attention to it, and more people are starting to change their behaviors. Do you feel hopeful in this moment?
I wouldn't say hopeful. Václav Havel said that hope is not optimism. It's the deep orientation of the soul towards what is right. And I'll tell you where I see some change. I see it in the millennials who are less consumer-oriented, who are living with less just objects around them. They're not collecting stuff. They are thinking carefully about the things that they use in their daily lives. So I think that those generations that are just behind mine are a source of possibility. And I also believe that we have a large research agenda to look at healthier and safer ways to live in this world.
Carolyn Raffensperger, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Carolyn Raffensperger is chair of the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club and director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. We've been talking about plastics, how we use them in our lives, ways to use fewer of them, and also technology to make plastics more environmentally friendly in the future. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.